All right, so hello everyone. I'm Colleen. I'm going to be talking to you today about memory elasticity. This particular work is a joint work with Florin Dinu, Aoun Raza, Waji Ol Hassan, and Professor Willy Svainopoul, and this work was done at EPFL. So, to delve right in, cluster operators care a lot about resource utilization. And it's, of course, natural because they want to get the best bang for the buck that they put into their infrastructure as possible. And you would typically have one or more frameworks like Hadoop, Spark, or Tez running on such a cluster. And you want to sort of maximize the performance of the data parallel applications you're running there. And so one idea is, what if we could do efficient resource utilization through under-provisioning of our applications? This, of course, is not a new idea. It has been done for other resources, but we wanted to look at memory because cluster memory typically is underutilized. So in this particular graph, you can see a timeline of an execution of about 5 hours worth of batch jobs in a cluster of 50 machines. So on your y-axis, you see exactly the total utilized memory. On your x-axis, you have your time. And this part here is the one that we're interested in using. We want to leverage this, pack more into it. Maybe have tasks that you could give less memory so they fit into this gap that we have right here. However, this is a tricky issue because the conventional wisdom says never touch memory. You don't want to do this. If you do, your app is going to crash. You're going to start thrashing. That's going to go all over the place. You're not going to be able to predict how your performance looks. So we wanted to see, okay, what if we could actually safely, deterministically, and with some modest impact to performance, actually do this? What if we could constrain applications? So to see if we could actually do this, we went and looked at batch jobs. And for that, I'm going to go into a bit of very high-level context as to what these jobs do. So typically, you have your input that you need to process. And in an ideal scenario is that you have enough memory available so that all the input you have fits into your memory, this ideal amount of memory, because you can fit everything in. And so your execution timeline then might look something like this. You're going to read your data, going to apply some computation, write out the result. It's all good. You're basically doing the minimum amount that you need to do to get this work done. And this is the ideal duration that you want to have for a task. You're not doing anything else except the bare minimum. Now, what happens if you have less than that amount of memory? Well, the nice part is that these batch jobs in particular will fill up what they can. When they reach the limit, they're going to rely on external storage to write out some intermediate data there and then combine it all at the end. So then your timeline, if you have less memory with these batch jobs, is going to look something more like this. You're going to read some data, spill what you can't handle as far as your buffer goes full, read back some more, spill, run your computation on those parts, merge everything, and write out your results. And the difference here is that you're doing this, you're still running properly, but you require a penalty, of course, because now you have to do all of this additional disk I/O to use external storage. So the key insight we found here was that these batch jobs are already handling memory under provisioning. They don't need any additional help. It's just that by spilling to disk these records, they are inquiring some additional penalty. So we figured, why not see how we could take use of that? And we call the certain property memory elasticity. Now, what is memory elasticity, basically? For the scenario that I just presented, where you have this non-ideal amount of memory, and you have this additional disk I/O, what you want is that by doing this, you're going to safely constrain your memory because you're not going to crash, because this is all how the batch jobs handle reduced memory. Your penalties are going to be moderate. You're not actually going to be that much slower. The behavior is going to be predictable enough that you can actually use it in different systems reliably. And the best part is, this is already in most data parallel apps. So you don't actually need to do anything that special. It's already there, but it's important to be aware of it. So to see that this is true, actually, we conducted an empirical study of memory elasticity. We looked at 18 different jobs across 8 different applications, where we constrained the memory of the tasks to measure the aforementioned penalty caused by all of that additional, additional I/O. And to make sure that we're fair, we bypassed the disk's buffer cache so that that wouldn't actually lower the penalties and make us look better falsely. And so we asked a few questions that we wanted to know about this memory elasticity property. Are these penalties in fact large? For a certain job, if I give it 90% of how much it would ideally want or 10%, how big is the variation between that? And since I'm doing more disk I/O, is this going to cause contention with my disks overall? And the interesting answer we found is actually not so much for any of these questions. So that was surprising for us, so we wanted to see why. So we first looked at what happens if you run Hadoop reducers, so for MapReduce for workloads, what if you run reducers with less memory than ideal? And on your y-axis there, you'll have the task execution time for each reducer normalized to the ideal duration. That would be when you're not spilling to disk, it's the best case scenario. And of course, the lower you are, the closer you are to one, the better off you're going to be. And for completeness, we looked at what happens if we give 10% of the ideal memory, 50%, or 90%. So big variations in how much memory you give compared to how much that task would need ideally. And our first surprise was, whoa, well, the median penalty is actually lower than 1.6x, which again goes quite against the convention that, you know, you're going to start thrashing, it's going to be very bad, it's going to go through the roof. Even the worst penalty we found was only about 3.3x. So why is that? Why are penalties manageable? Well, the first part is that your data input buffer is actually going to take up most of a typical data parallel application's memory. So then when you're encountering this memory pressure, it actually gets absorbed by your data buffer, and that's not going to impact the correctness of what happened, of how it works. Secondly, spilling to disk is actually done sequential. And that means that spilling records to disk can end up being faster than just doing OS paging, for example. So it's highly efficient use of your disk. Finally, most external merging algorithms are logarithmic in the number of passes that they need from the chunks you have, which means even if you're spilling, you're going to require far fewer merge steps than the actual number of spills you're doing. So that's why actually penalties are modest. Now, the next thing we wanted to see is, okay, we have modest penalties, but how do these actually vary across different amounts of memory? And we found, whoa, so we're giving these either 10% or 90% of memory, and the penalties actually only vary by about 0.25x. So that's 9 times less memory and yet not a lot of overhead. So why is that? Well, it turns out that a lot of these applications have a static threshold at which they will start spilling data. And what this means is, let's say you have an input, and which is constant, 2.1 gigabytes, and you have two separate scenarios. The first one on the left, your buffer is going to be 2 gigabytes, so a lot of memory there. What you're going to do is start reading in your input, you're going to fill up your buffer, spill 2 gigabytes, finish reading the input, and that's it. In the second scenario, on the right, your buffer is going to be 10 times smaller, 200 megabytes. So in this case, you're going to start reading in your input. You're going to start to spill, read, spill, read, spill, about 10 times doing this. However, both cases, you're still only spilling 2 gigabytes. That's the amount of data you're going to be reading and writing to your disk. So this static spilling threshold is actually the reason why, even if you give 90% or 10%, you're going to be in the same ballpark. We also looked at other tasks, for example, the Hadoop mappers. What we found is that here the penalties are even lower. You're looking at about 1.2x for the median, and the variation is down to 0.05x for these guys. So even lower penalties, even more stable in terms of variation. We finally looked at frameworks like Spark and Tez, a few jobs which resemble the same type of work. The penalties are still very low, about 1.75x, and the variation is 0.3x, about on par with the Hadoop reducers that we presented before. Now, finally, we wanted to know what's going to happen with the additional disk I/O we're doing. Is it going to cause disk contention? And so what we did is we started to look at several apps. What happens if we run concurrently several reducers which are going to spill to disk because they are under-provisioned, as opposed to just running them sequentially. And on your y-axis, you have the average slowdown. Again, lower is better. The closer we are to one, the smaller the actual overhead. And on your x-axis, you have the number of concurrent reducers that you are going to run. And so what we found in principle is that for a typical configuration where you provision more or about one disk per two cores, your slowdown is going to be less than 10% overall. But even if you go further, and let's say you provision far less than that, which is, again, not typical, but let's say you do that, even for up to one disk per five cores, your degradation goes up to at most 25%. So to sum up, what we found and was very interesting for us was that the performance penalties are modest, about 1.6x for the median. The penalties themselves are about the same whether you give 10% or 90% of your memory. And finally, your disk contention is not going to be such a factor for the existing cluster setups you have nowadays. So with that in mind, we wanted to see, okay, we know we have this property. Can we model it? Is it sufficiently stable that we can use it in something else? And so what we want to do ideally is look at how does this penalty vary for a certain class of task. Let's say you want to know if you have on your y-axis the percentage of ideal memory that you can give from 10% to, let's say, 100% of the ideal memory. How will your normalized execution time, again, lower would be better, would vary with the amount of penalty, with the amount of memory you're giving. As a bit of an insight, your penalty is typically a function of your disk speed, your input size, and your framework configuration. And while the latter two are usually constant within your system, or you can find them through some means of interrogating your framework, the former is something you don't have right away, which is why you need to do something else to find it. Now, we know that the penalties vary very little between these percentages, so we suggested let's use a step model as sort of a baseline for that, because we've seen that 90%, 50%, 10% are very similar. So we have this step function that basically characterizes the disk I/O overhead you're going to be seeing. And you only need two profiling runs then to get this information. One where you give the task the ideal amount of memory, that is 100% or more. Everything fits into memory, everything is good. And one where you give it less than that. You measure these two points, you can actually infer any other point on your graph, which, of course, follows it is a step function. And that is actually the baseline for all the other models that we have. We also constructed more complex models, but for brevity, we're not going to go into that right now. You can find a more detailed analysis in our paper. And this is the accuracy, for example, that we found for our reducer model. On your y-axis, you have the real duration as measured for a task normalized to the model. And of course, the closer you are to one, again, the better off you're going to be. And so we looked at various reducers across the applications, and we found that on average, most of these reducers are within plus minus 5% of our model. So that's actually highly stable and much better than we actually initially expected. So to sum up, the step model itself is an adequate approximation with more complex models available. You only need two profiling points to infer this model, and these models are very robust. So okay, we know we have this property, it's ubiquitous, it's very okay to model. Let's see how we can leverage that. And one way we can do it is actually we can trade off the time a task will be queuing to receive certain resources for the time it'll take to run. For example, on your left-hand side, you see a simple timeline execution of three tasks on one node. On your y-axis, you have your memory. On your x-axis, you have the duration. And if you, on one situation, you need to run them sequentially because you do not have more resources. On the right-hand side, you are able to start the second task right away because you're giving it less memory. And that actually means that despite the fact the task is running longer, it's actually going to make the overall job finish faster because it's not going to wait so much for resources to become available. So in our system, which we call the yarn memory elasticity, our decision process boils down to one invariant. You should only make an elastic allocation if and only if that does not exceed the expected job completion time. So if you take as a baseline just vanilla Yarn and you run these containers sequentially, you might have a situation in the second case where running one of them elastically is going to be faster and you're better off, and one in which maybe it's not going to happen and running one of them elastically is going to take longer, which is what you do not want to happen. We had to create two components in addition to what a typical vanilla Yarn setup would look like. One of them is the timeline generator, which simply runs across all the running and pending queues and sums up about how much a certain job should keep running. And the other one is the profiler, which gives you the metadata from before, your ideal duration, your ideal memory, and the penalty for your task. And we're going to revisit the graph from before, where on a 50-node cluster, we ran a homogeneous trace of 5 PageRank jobs. And what we found is that we were able to increase memory utilization to about 95% while reducing the overall duration of this particular set of jobs by about 40%. So we wanted to see what are the benefits in terms of execution time that you can actually achieve with this technique. And we first wanted to look at heterogeneous workloads. So you have a trace of various PageRank, recommender, and word count jobs on the same 50-node cluster. On your y-axis, you're going to have the improvement of our technique over Yarn, which higher is better. And we are going to be looking at a breakdown. Your blue bar is going to be your average job completion time. Your red bar is your make span. The last two bars, green and purple, are your map phases and reduce phases, respectively. And so what we found is that we achieve approximately about 65% improvement, both for job completion time and make span, when we look at the execution of these traces. Now, what if your workload is more homogeneous? Maybe you're looking at a certain type of application that is preponderantly run within your cluster. So we looked at PageRank. We ran the same amount of job for a different number of concurrent runs. On your x-axis now, you're going to see the number of concurrent runs for the same job that you have. And we looked at the improvement, again, for average job completion time, make span, and map and reduce phases, respectively. And what we found was that we were able to achieve 40% improvement for average job completion time and for make span. So with this, we wanted to see what we could also further achieve with our system. So we created the discrete scheduler simulator, which mimics the behavior of both vanilla Yarn and our implementation of Yarn memory elasticity. By the way, it's open source. You can find it online. We conducted two important analyses. One, the former, is a parameter sweep across a trace where we looked at traces that would run up to about 3,000 nodes, more than 8,000 traces of different configurations. And our results were pretty much comparable with what we found in our previous workloads. We also conducted a robustness analysis to see how much the accuracy of the information regarding your model is going to influence your setup. And we looked at more than 20,000 traces and concluded that the system is very robust to these changes. And we further detailed this in the paper. Finally, on some of the existing related work, there has been work that does better resource utilization through efficient packing. Out of these, graphene actually does some attempt to do resource underutilization, but it does not touch on memory. Some systems will try to collocate batch jobs with latency-critical services. Some will look at resource overcommitting, for example, Apollo and Borg, but these systems will typically kill one of the lower priority jobs if resource contention occurs. And finally, there is work that decides just to suspend tasks if there's memory pressure to reclaim that memory, and that would be iTask. So to conclude, the main takeaway is you don't have to cry over your spilled records if you end up spilling more, because thankfully there's memory elasticity, a property that guarantees that you're going to have low penalties if this happens because of the way that batch jobs handle things. This is going to be highly predictable. You can model it. Memory elasticity can be leveraged in scheduling to trade off your task queuing time for your running time. And we've shown that with our system, our memory elasticity aware YARN implementation can achieve up to 60% improvements in average job completion time. And finally, as I've mentioned, our simulator code is online. Feel free to look it up, submit pull requests, and so on. And that was my talk. Thank you for listening. I will be happy to take questions.
Hi, Fred Douglas, Dell EMC. So I'm curious about your memory elasticity argument that early on you had that slide with the 2.1 gigs of data and right. 2 gigs of buffers. And if you said it was about the same whether you had 200 megs and you did it many times or 2 gigs and you flushed all at once. And the question mm-hmm. is, if you did it incrementally, if you had a bunch of 200 meg buffers and when you ran out of them, you flushed one of them, you would end up flushing much less. And so are there no applications that will do that and will actually benefit from having almost all the memory they need?
So that's actually a great question. We had considered this. So in fact, for example, Hadoop does spill in the manner that we described. But to sum up, even if you were to do something better, to spill partially halfway, that would actually not influence our penalties, for one. So your penalties would still be pretty low. What would happen, though, is that they would actually be even lower if you gave more memory. So in the beginning, you would actually have even lower penalties. So what you might want to do then is you might want to account for this if you do a particular model for that, for a framework that does a more intelligent way of spilling things. But the property itself would not be negatively impacted. It would actually be somewhat to its gain.